There are laws, that there are factors that govern this universe that we can discover and that we can determine by the scientific method. There are things that cannot be proven scientifically, but those that are, we should respect. Sometimes we're accused as creation scientists of not respecting science. I think the very opposite is true. I think there are laws that have been established that are trampled by the theoretical concepts of evolution, and I think we can illustrate that this evening. In times gone by, the dominant scientists, and those who I think were among the greatest scientists that ever lived, viewed the laws of science as the laws of God. As Kepler and Sir Isaac Newton have said, when we study science, we're thinking God's thoughts after Him. And that's really where the concept of science was developed. Prior to the concept of God's laws governing the universe, people thought there were all kinds of mystical spirits that caused various phenomena to occur, and you couldn't really repeat it because the spirit may be willing and may not be willing. But when we understand that God rules and that His laws govern, then and only then can we really do science. The science that we know today was born from the womb of faith in God's laws. But when we look at the principles that govern this universe and see that they work in Arkansas and they work in Texas and they work in China, I think it raises some serious questions. Why is that true? I think it's because there's a lawgiver. And that implication bothers some people, obviously, who don't want to believe in God. Notice the statement by James Shea, who's editor of the Journal of Geological Education. He says the concept, that is, the concept of laws of physics, is anachronistic. It's old-fashioned, it's outdated, in that it originated at a time when the Almighty was thought to have established the laws of nature and to have decreed that nature must obey them. That's old-fashioned. We've learned better than that, he says. It's a great pity for the philosophy of science that the word law was ever invented. Now, can you imagine a physicist who doesn't believe that there are laws of physics? It's amazing, but that's how far he's driven from this implication that there's a lawgiver. I think the great physicists know better than that. Albert Einstein would certainly qualify, and he's speaking in this quote about the principles of thermodynamics. Now, that's a word that may scare some people. It sounds like something we don't understand, but that's not the case. You may not use the term, but I guarantee you, you understand the concept very well. But referring to the various laws of thermodynamics, and we'll look basically at two, he says, this is the only physical theory of universal content concerning which I'm convinced that within the framework of applicability of its concepts, it will never be overthrown. In other words, this one is, sure enough, a real law. And this is the one that I have more confidence in than anything. Now, what is he talking about? The first law of thermodynamics is sometimes referred to as the law of conservation. It tells us that matter and energy can be interchanged at times, but neither can be absolutely created out of nothing or destroyed so that nothing exists. It doesn't come into existence or go out of existence. Now, we burn things up, but it just changes its form and goes off into smoke and gas and so forth. But you don't really destroy it or create it. That is the natural law. If you get something created out of nothing, you've got something supernatural. The natural law says you can't do that. Isaac Asimov is one of the more famous atheists in our country, written over 600 books. Someone said actually has written more books than he's read, which I don't think is really true, but one of the more famous atheists. He says, this law is considered the most powerful and most fundamental generalization about the universe that scientists have ever been able to make. He says, no one knows why energy is conserved, and I think he should speak for himself. I think we may have more insight into that before we finish this evening. But he says, all that anyone can say is that in over a century and a quarter of careful measurement, scientists have never been able to point to a definite violation of energy conservation, either in the familiar everyday surroundings about us, or in the heavens above, or in the atoms within. Now, that's about as broad a scope as you can imagine. From the heavens to the atoms, there's never been a violation. Now, this is what it takes to become a law of science. You test, you repeat, you reproduce, you observe, you set up tests so that if this happens, it's verified, if that happens, it's falsified. These things have been done, and it has produced more confidence than any other principle they know about. It says that you can't bring something into existence out of nothing. And yet, how did we get what we've got? You see what the naturalist has to deal with here. The law of uniformity says that all things came into existence as a result of present processes. I say law with quotes. This is the assumption of the naturalist, and this principle denies God, but says you get things by the same processes that we see happening, but you can't get things out of nothing. Well, they have a challenge here. This, of course, is a theory, and they affirm that all things came into existence by such natural processes. But how do you reconcile that with this first law that they have more confidence in than anything else, that says you can't get something out of nothing? Well, let's notice how Isimov tries to deal with that. He says, perhaps in an infinite sea of nothingness, you can imagine that, sounds like there's something, doesn't it? Globs of positive and negative energy. Yep, he's got something in his nothingness there. But anyway, an infinite sea of nothingness, there's positive and negative globs of equal-sized pairs are constantly forming, and after passing through evolutionary changes, are combining once more and vanishing. We are in one of these globs in the period of time between nothing and wondering about it. Now, this is supposed to be a scientist who says the most fundamental generalization about the universe scientists have ever been able to make is that you can't get something out of nothing. And yet this is the kind of nonsense he writes when he's then confronted with the implications of how you explain that without God. This is not even good science fiction. But we have this principle of uniformity, which is, of course, a theory, in conflict with the principle of conservation, which says nothing can be created or destroyed. One's a law, and one's a theory. Which one ought to prevail when we see the conflict? I think that's a rather easy question to answer. The second law has just as many, maybe even more, conflict with the theories of evolution. The second law says that things go downhill. You didn't know that, did you? We all understand that well. It's called the principle of entropy increase. Scientists like to make it difficult to say things upside down and backwards. Entropy is the measure of disorder, and that increases. Okay, it's going downhill. The system runs down or tends toward disorganization is the second law. Isimov is talking about this when he says another way of stating the second law then is the universe is constantly getting more disorderly. Viewed that way, we can see the second law all about us. Another, he says we have to work hard to straighten a room, but left to itself it becomes a mess again quickly, very easily. Even if we never enter it, it becomes musty and dusty, and how difficult to maintain our houses, machinery, our own bodies in perfect working order. Did any of you know that? This is not news to anybody, is it? We all experience it. It's the second law of thermodynamics, as the scientists describe it, or principle of entropy increase, when you want to use fancy words. But it says things go downhill, which we all understand. How easy to let them deteriorate. You have to work to make it go up. You just do nothing, it goes downhill. In fact, all we have to do is nothing, and everything deteriorates, collapses, breaks down, wears out all by itself. And that's what the second law is all about. And again, this is something we all understand all too well. We buy a new house and it doesn't get brighter and shinier. It deteriorates and goes down all by itself, doesn't it? And we wind up with things that look like this. Because this is an illustration of what has been defined as the second law of thermodynamics. But now the principle of evolution says that things go in which direction? The opposite direction. In fact, it's defined by Theodosius Dobzhansky as a directional process that gives rise to increase. And that's the way the evolutionist views the whole universe. Here's Chiasson of Harvard in his book Cosmic Evolution. The whole cosmos is going upward. The rise of complexity in nature is the biolite. He thinks the whole world is going the opposite way of this second law, which is the most fundamental generalization scientists have ever been able to make. In the book cover, he says, along an arrow of time, starting with the Big Bang, Chiasson depicts cosmic evolution in a wide range of systems, particulate, galactic, stellar, planetary, chemical, biological, cultural, just pervades the whole universe. Over time, all these systems, be they manifested in worms, human brains, or microchips, become both more complex and more ordered. Now, I think we can see a difference here in the law. As Einstein said, the one that he is confident will never be overthrown, and this theory that says we think it's all going the opposite direction and we try to explain it without God. I think you can see the challenge here. There is the principle of evolution that says things go up, and there is the entropy increase principle, the second law of thermodynamics, that says they go down. And one of them is a theory, and one of them is a law, and which one ought to prevail? Well, we present this from time to time, and scientists are very, very familiar with the second law. But the typical response is, well, we understand that systems, as you measure them, do go downhill, but you can overpower that when you have extra energy and make water, for instance, run uphill if you have an engine and a pump and electricity and extra energy here to make it go uphill. And you see the acorn that grows to the big oak tree. Of course, you've got the information guiding that with the DNA, and you've got all the extra energy from the sun. But if you have extra energy, then you can make things go uphill, and the sun is the source of this energy, and the earth is open to the energy of the sun, and that drives the upward process. Now, that's the standard answer to the second law. You have an open system. And typically, they'll just say, well, the second law doesn't work if you have an open system, which is ignorant. Let's notice the statement in Chemical Engineering News, for example, that addresses that particularly. John Ross of Harvard says, ordinarily the second law is stated for isolated systems. That's because you're trying to deal with it in terms of equations and make the balance come out. But the second law applies equally well to open systems. All systems are really open, and we all know things still go downhill, don't they? Sommerfeld, in his book Thermodynamics and Statistical Mechanics, says the quantity of entropy generated locally cannot be negative, irrespective of whether the system's isolated or not. Entropy, the measure of disorder, has to be positive. It cannot be negative. It doesn't matter whether it's open or not. Now, yes, you can have extra energy and make things go up, but you must have more than extra energy. And this is the thing that's missed in this objection. I think it's illustrated in the statement by Simpson and Beck, and George Gaylord Simpson's one of the more famous evolutionists from Harvard. He says the simple expenditure of energy, which we do have bathing the earth from the sun, but the simple expenditure of energy is not sufficient to develop and maintain order. This is a necessary requirement. It's not a sufficient requirement. He illustrates a bull in a china shop performs work, but he neither creates nor maintains organization. We can understand that. You have lots of energy, but you need more than just energy. You need directed energy. The work needed is particular work. It must follow specifications. It requires information on how to proceed. And I think this really helps us understand the problem. If we focus in on the information content, for instance, of the simple cell we talked about on the radio this afternoon, Carl Sagan of Cornell, one of the more famous evolutionist says the information content of the simple cell has been estimated at around 10 to the 12th bits. Now, energy from the sun bathes the earth. Okay, we understand the energy, but that's not all that's necessary. You've got to have information. Where did the information come from? You just heard the answer that I get on college campuses all the time. They just get real quiet when you ask that question. He said this 10 to the 12th bits is comparable to about 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Now, that's a tremendous amount of information. Where did it come from? How do you account for the increase of information? I understand energy. Okay, we got plenty. That's necessary, but it's not sufficient. You've got to have information as well, and they have no answer for that. They pretend that it's not a problem. Now, mutations are the result of a decrease in information. Here is a copying process, and something goes wrong, and you lose a little bit of the information in the process. We talked last night about the blind salamander in Texas that has lost its eyes. And that's sometimes touted as an example of evolution. But he's lost his eyes. He hasn't gained anything. He's lost something. And that's what you see with mutations. It's a loss of information. Now, the challenge is to find an example of a mutation that results in an increase in information. If you understand what mutations are, that's nonsense. It doesn't work that way. It goes downhill. And this is a challenge that simply is not answered. The question was asked Richard Dawkins recently, can you come up with an example of a mutation that is actually an illustration of an increase of information? We understand the mutation of the salamander losing its eyes. That's downhill. But can you find it going uphill? Let me make an adjustment here. And I'll let you listen to Mr. Dawkins himself. We use these quotes sometimes, and you hear what I tell you what the people say, but how would you like to hear him himself?
Mr. Dawkins, can you give an example of a genetic mutation or an evolutionary process which can be seen to increase the information in the genome? There's a popular misunderstanding of evolution which says that fish turned into reptiles and reptiles turned into mammals, and so somehow we ought to be able to look around the world today and look at our ancestors. We ought to be able to see the intermediates between fish and reptiles, or between reptiles and mammals. We ought to be able to see fish kind of on the way to becoming reptiles. But of course that's not the way it is at all. Fish are modern animals. They're just as modern as we are. They're descended from ancestors, which we're descended from. Way back 300 million years ago, there would have been an ancestor, which was the ancestor of modern fish and the ancestor of modern humans. And that ancestor, if you could have been there then, you could have seen the first steps towards the fish, say, coming out onto the land and becoming something like an amphibian. But that was a long time ago. You wouldn't expect to see that today.
Did you hear him give an example of an increase of information? That's what he was asked. And he did not have an answer, and doesn't have an answer, and he muddled around and talked about something else, but it's obvious. He doesn't have that answer, and I ask the question constantly on college campuses, and that's better than I get most of the time. Now, let's just think about that for a minute. We've spent millions of dollars in this country looking up into the sky for some indication of intelligence. A few dots and a few dashes would just produce euphoria with the scientist, and you'd see headlines around the world. Wouldn't have to have much information, but just some. But here's a scientist who looks down the microscope instead of up the telescope, and he sees the DNA. And in that DNA, the equivalent of 100 million pages of the Encyclopedia Britannica. And he says, no, I don't see any sign of intelligence. Does that make sense? if he were walking along the beach and he saw John loves Mary, he would say, ah, here is something that was produced by intelligence. But he sees 100 million pages and there's no intelligence there. Does that make sense to you? I think it makes nonsense. The information is unexplainable. We look at the sun, and okay, it's bathing the earth, and that's necessary to produce the upward process, but it's not a sufficient explanation. There must also be information. And where did the information come from? That's the answer. They have no answer, because I've asked it hundreds of times on college campuses, and I know they don't have an answer. And you heard what Dawkins had to say in response to that. We can see illustrations of this principle of the second law of thermodynamics, and the idea of an open system simply doesn't answer it. It's an insufficient answer to say we get energy from the sun. We see this downward process illustrated in so many ways around us. One of the more dramatic is the life of the past. The typical picture that we see in the textbooks is that here are the little horses getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And here's the little graduated chart of man, and he's getting bigger and bigger and bigger. This is a lie. This is an upside-down picture of the fossil record, and every paleontologist knows this. The life of the past was not smaller and now bigger today. It's the other way around. It was bigger in the past and is smaller today invariably. Notice the statement by Gould regarding the nature of the fossil record. The sweep of anatomical diversity. Now you see, the anatomy was supposed to be very simple to start with and gradually got more diverse as time went. Well, where is the most diverse? It should be most diverse today and simple in the past, right? The sweep of anatomical diversity reached a maximum right after the initial diversification of multicellular animals. In other words, right at the start is when it was most diverse. And we've lost a bunch. It's gone downhill since then. The later history of life proceeded by elimination, not expansion. It's a downhill process. Von England and Castor, in their geology textbook, says also that mammalian life was richer in kinds, of larger sizes, and had a more abundant expression in the Pliocene than in later years. That's true of each of the periods. This is just one example for one period, but we'll illustrate it from all. Richard Leakey and his father Lewis, pictured here, are among the most famous evolutionists, made famous in National Geographic, and here the father, Lewis, is pictured examining fossils from gorge in Africa. He's been scouring the gorge since 1931. Over the years, he's unearthed the bones of an ancient pig as big as a rhino. You all have all seen those. That's what you see in the fossil record. A 6-foot-tall sheep, a 12-foot-tall bird, maybe on Sesame Street, but not running around that I've seen, the flat-top skull of a wrecked nutcracker man, which I think was a big ape. This is what he was digging up. Do you see pigs as big as a rhino? Well, in the fossil record, you do. This is from the Dakota School of Mines. Here's one of the fossil pigs, the one on the right. But we don't see these walking around today. How big were the rhinos? Well, the rhinos were up to 20 feet tall. This is one from India. Back to the article regarding Lewis Leakey. He's pictured here with a fossil ram compared with a modern ram in the background, a pretty good size one. But I haven't seen anything like what you see in the fossil record. But that's not what you're told in the textbooks, is it? Turkana Boy was discovered by his son, Richard Leakey, in Africa. He was 5'6" in height, which doesn't sound too impressive until we understand he was 9 years old. Now, we have some 9-year-olds here probably, and I will venture to say I know they're not 5'6" at 9 years of age. Probably not at 13 years of age. But this is what you see in the fossil record. We'll talk more about that Friday night when we talk about fossil man. We've all seen the little graduated horse charts about things getting bigger. This is the depiction of a donkey that was that we helped excavate near Lubbock, Texas. It was 9 feet tall at the shoulder. Y'all have all seen donkeys 9 feet tall at the shoulder. You've seen the little graduated horse charts, so they're supposed to be getting bigger over time and smaller in the past, but this kind of messes up the horse chart. Of course, they leave that out, and so they can say it the way they want to say it. From the same area, we excavated this bison, had a 12-foot horn span, 11 feet tall at the shoulder. Not many of those running around, but there were in the fossil record. We've all seen the armadillos that get run over by the pickup trucks. This one could run over the pickup truck. This is from a geology text, and this is their depiction of it, 9 times larger than the present-day armadillos. This announcement was made in the 1999 Society of Vertebrate Paleontology meeting, actually in Austin, Texas. An armadillo the size of an elephant? What would that look like? Maybe something like that? I don't know. You pickups would look out, wouldn't they? This was 2 years ago, 2004, June, in the BBC News, Stone Age elephant, but it was twice the size. Now, elephants are big, but this was twice the size of a modern elephant, bones of other large animals, right, and all of them bigger, rhinoceros, buffalo, wild horses. Here's an artist's depiction. I think they're playing around with Photoshop here, but here's what it would have looked like. You don't see that today, but if you had them alive from the fossil record, that's what you'd see compared to today. From down in Big Bend in Texas, we have this skeleton of a fossil turtle, and it looks for all the world like modern turtles. The difference is this one was 14 feet across. I think this screen is 8 feet. You double the screen and you get life size here compared with a 7-foot basketball player. This is what they look like in the fossil record. You get the picture. Also from Big Bend, we've got a fossil crocodile, 20-foot crocodile here in the foreground, and they very rarely get that big. That's as big as they get today. But this one would have been about 50 feet. In fact, there was an article in National Geographic just recently about one 40 feet long that they found in the fossil record, but not swimming around today. We saw Jaws in the movie, and it was about 25 feet long. The 14-foot shark is represented by the jaws in the center. The one in the middle would have been twice as big, that is, the one surrounding it would have been twice as big as Jaws, about 50 feet long, depicted here in this illustration from the textbook. Seen any sharks as bigger than a bus? No. We're all familiar with the beaver. Nice sized little rodent, can do a lot of damage, even with that small size. Though, imagine what it would be like if he were 10 feet tall. Here's one 10 feet long, 3-foot tail. This is a skeleton of one that size from the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago. Irish elk, some of you may be elk hunters. Have you ever found one with a 13-foot horn span? That's what you see in the fossil record. Dallas Morning News reported just a few years ago, 2003, a dig from down in Venezuela, referred to as Mighty Mouse. Buffalo-sized rodents. I'm glad they're not around. Buffalo-sized rodents. In fact, Science News referred to it as Ratzilla. What's happened to the rats? What's happened to the buffalo? What's happened to the camels? Here's a depiction of a fossil found in 2005 over in Syria. The one on the left is the fossil. It's twice as big. This is the way it's described by the BBC News, double the size of modern-day camels in the past. A more recent find referred to, and I won't try to pronounce that name, nicknamed the Demon Duck of Doom. Huge duck, 8 feet tall. Seen any 8 foot tall ducks? May have weighed 500 pounds. may have been carnivorous. Now, the statue representing it is kind of nice looking. But if it's a carnivorous duck 8 feet tall, maybe it looked more like this. But I think you're getting the picture. Here's the headline from Science News. Killer kangaroo once roamed Australia. Enormous creature, over 400 pounds. Invariably, in the fossil record, they were bigger. And what does your science teacher tell you? Well, they were smaller and they got bigger and bigger over time. It's a lie. Sorry, that's just what it is. It's not so. Here we're looking at a ground sloth, 20 feet tall. Some of the bigger ones are up to 6 feet today. Most of them are smaller. Here is a skeleton of one from the past at the Price Museum in Utah. This is really not a large one. I measured the hand on this one. It was 18 inches. There was one found within a month of when I was there. The hand was twice that, 36 inches. This one is 18 inches. We've all seen the cattails here in Arkansas. We've got some big ones in Texas. In the fossil record, they were typically over 100 feet tall. We're not talking about just animals. We're talking about insects. We're talking about plants. Here are cycads, one of the more common fossils of the fossil record, displayed as they appear today in the Dakota School of Mines. This is their placard. I put the coin up there for scale, about 18 inches tall. But notice the description. Fossil cycads here from the textbook. Quite large, stem over 4 feet in diameter. That's more than 18 inches tall, obviously. And insects were huge. Here, Simak, writing in the book Trilobite, Dinosaur, and Man, says, in general, all the Pennsylvanian insects were larger. And, of course, Pennsylvania, I don't think, is a time period, but an environment like a swamp, that's where you find insects. A few of them were larger. No, that's not what he says. Is it? All of them were larger. How big was the dragonfly? 27 inches. And I've seen them bigger than that. This one is 27. All of them. Now, of course, you've read that in your textbook, right? Not a one of you have read that information. Here from 2002, describing what's found in Australia, a 12-foot-tall bird once roamed the Australian outback. Kangaroos, giant kangaroos, wombats the size of cars, discovered near Alice. Over and over and over, that's what you see in the fossil record. I was up in Illinois, I dug up a cockroach a foot and a half long. My wife wouldn't let me bring it in the house. It's a rot. No, it's a cockroach. It's not coming in. It's out in the garage. Typical. Of course, we look at the dinosaurs. We know they were big. We've seen the movies depicting them. Seismosaurus was huge. This is one remnant. There is one representative of the dinosaurs that's still around today, the Tuatara. We find it in the fossil record all around the world. It's only found in New Zealand today. And it looks very dinosaurian, but it is of the same family as the dinosaurs. It's about 8 inches long. You get the picture. It's all going downhill. Now, is that because of the second law of thermodynamics? I'm not sure I can prove that. But it looks like it. It's going downhill like everything else, and it gives me a chance at least to counter the idea that, or the lie that is expressed in so many textbooks, that everything is getting bigger and bigger and evolving over time. It is not so. All right, we're going to stop at this point and see if some of you have some questions. Then we'll look at a lot more illustrations, and especially from astronomy. Yes? Absolutely. Now, I've shown you the more dramatic examples. We have a database right now of just over 400 creatures from the fossil record compared with creatures that are still alive today. Now, we have fewer things alive than were in the fossil record because things are going downhill and becoming extinct. more in the past. But of the ones that are still alive today that we can compare with the fossil record, we have 400. The average increase is about 50%. In other words, we see not the nine times with everything, but the average is a 50% or decrease in information, that is, in size, for all 400. We know this is a real phenomenon, and it is pervasive. We've obviously picked some of the more dramatic examples to help make the point. Man, we've got 2 8-foot skeletons that we found in Italy. Cro-Magnon man averaged 6'6 in height. And Neanderthal was shorter. He averaged about 5'8. But that's certainly well within the range, certainly much bigger than the Bushmen that we see running around today. I think in general they were larger, maybe not twice as large, but they were significantly larger in the past, and I think we can show that. We've got some of the footprints at Glen Rose. The Burdick track is 13 inches long. It's one size smaller than Shaquille O'Neal. That's what we see in the fossil record. Well, yes, the dinosaurs were much bigger. We don't have creatures that big. Things in general are going downhill. It's tempting to get into some of the reports that maybe we still have some dinosaurs around today. They're typically smaller when we hear the accounts. We don't have that documented. We've got some good evidence that we think is going to be announced very shortly. But instead of Brontosaurus 150 feet long like Seismosaurus, they're more like 40 feet long, which is still a good-sized critter, but not as big as they were for several reasons. But things typically are going downhill, and I think that would fit. We do know that reptiles don't stop growing. They grow all of their life. An alligator may be sexually mature at 3 feet, but he may grow to 15 feet. If they lived longer, as humans did before the flood, then they would continue to grow and get much larger. And I think that accounts for something like Seismosaurus, which was probably a great-great-grandpa. The sexually mature may have been quarter of that size. Other questions? Yes. Well, as we pointed out when we talked about the principle of model comparison, you can always make any model fit with enough secondary assumptions. And the secondary assumption is, well, the conditions have changed and they're not right for forming as they were when they formed a long time ago. Now, that's not a direct prediction. The direct prediction is it happens naturally. We should be able to see it. It doesn't, well, okay, let's come up with an assumption to make it fit, and that says it's not as good a model. But they'll say, no, the conditions are not as good today. In fact, they're impossible today. And they'll acknowledge this. When you have oxygen in the atmosphere, you can't, the Miller-Urey experiment where you have the formation of amino acids, it's in all of the textbooks, as an illustration of the formation of life naturally, requires a reducing atmosphere, an atmosphere without oxygen. And so that you've got amino acids and so forth forming as a result of this ammonia and methane, but no oxygen. If you've got oxygen, it will not form. Okay, we got oxygen today, so it can't happen. They realized that it wouldn't form if there were radiation the cosmic radiation that the atmosphere protects us from. We got to have the ozone layer. Why? Because we'd be bathed in radiation, and that'd be very deleterious to life. And life wouldn't form under such circumstances. But ozone is what? It's another form of oxygen. And if you've got ozone, you've got oxygen. And if you've got oxygen, it won't work. But if you don't have it, then you've got the radiation and it won't work. So you've got a dilemma there that is real, real difficult for them to try to deal. But they'll come up with all of these assumptions that, and with enough, they can make it sound reasonable. Ours just fits directly. Other questions? Yes. There are 20 amino acids that form life, and all of them are left-handed. They're handed. The Urey-Miller experiment produced hundreds of different kinds, and randomly right and left-handed. Now, how do you get them segregated, get down to the 20, and then all left-handed, and then you just have amino acids that are necessary to form life. You have to put them together then in the right sequence, a sequence of hundreds in the right sequence in order to form something. It's like saying, okay, I got some bricks out here, now I've explained the building with its plumbing and electricity and lights and because I know how to make brick. Okay, well, that's not a very good explanation of the building. Yes? Yes. I'd qualify the animals that Adam named. I think there's been some misperception of that, and some problems due to translation. The term describing the animals of the field, that phrase is described as agricultural animals in other places. I think these were the animals that we would normally come in contact with that are tame, that are associated with man. I don't think it necessarily included the lions and the tigers and dinosaurs and so forth. That phrase, animals of the field, refers to tame agricultural animals. That's an excellent question, I'm not saying they'd be wild as they are today, but the term itself refers to is used to refer to things like cows and horses and pigs and things that man lives with. Did he live with the lions back then? That's a good question. I'm not sure. But the term is much more limited. It doesn't say that he named all the animals that were created. I don't think that's implied. And there was another part of your question too, besides naming animals, on the ark. Yes. I think it's very obvious the dinosaurs were on the ark. We have proof in the fact that these stones that you see in here were carved by men 1,500, 2,000 years ago. The flood was 4,000 years ago, 4,500 years ago. They were still seeing them. They were seeing them in 1186 when this Stegosaurus was carved on the side of the temple there in Cambodia. If they survived the flood, they had to be on the ark. And certainly the ark was big enough. That's another subject, but we have a DVD covering that. Good question. Yes. It just says everything's going downhill. They went extinct. The dodo bird, the carrier pigeon. Some of the environmentalists say we're losing a species every month. Now, of course, we're not getting a new one to replace it each month. that's obvious. I think they're overstating the case, but what they're saying is it's all going downhill quick, which is what I'm saying. That's the opposite of evolution. Yes, sir. There was an article in Newsweek just a couple of years ago describing some of the footprints of Brontosaurus actually in China, and says they were the size of calves. They were small, but there was a herd of them. Well, obviously, as they mature and get to be grandpas, they get much, much bigger and continue to grow all their life, but they could have been the size of calves. Would have been no problem. Maybe the size of elephants. But when you have an ark almost 2 football fields long and as high as a 5-story building, you've got plenty of room. There's a book called The Feasibility, Noah's Ark, A Feasibility Study, done by John Woodmerappy, which goes into great detail about the capacity of the ark and the number of animals that would have to be on there, and answers everything you'd want to know and probably 10 times more about objections to the ark and some of those issues. Thank you very much for your questions. Let's take about a 5-minute break, and then we'll come back and look at some astronomy and some other real good examples of the laws of science. How are you this evening? Good. If I can get my comment.